Yeah, so today I'm going to talk as described about the nucleosynthesis around black hole accretion disk. This is work that I've been doing with Gail. Gail talked very nicely yesterday about the neutrinos from these disks, and we'll see today that they play a pretty important role in the nucleosynthesis that I'm going to discuss. Okay, so I thank Chris for giving a nice introduction on Tuesday about the different sites of nucleosynthesis within a supernova and within a gamma ray burst. Here's a little cartoon just to reiterate what's going on in the gamma ray burst. So you can have nucleosynthesis. This is my silly cartoon that I apologize for the silliness, but anyway, you can get a picture. We have some nucleosynthesis in a jet. It's very, very unpoor, but we can still have something happening there. But the bulk of the nucleosynthesis probably occurs in the two other sites. The exploding shell, you get explosive nucleosynthesis in the shell, and this is something that Nimoto, Nidia, and Chris and Amy are working on. But today I'm going to concentrate entirely on nucleosynthesis from this accretion disk around the black hole, so this middle site within the gamma ray burst. So why are we interested in this? Well, models of these disks show that up to half the mass in the disk can be lost in outflows. And so it becomes an important question as to what we're making in this disk. Some of the things that we might be making are nickel-56. So Chris mentioned that you can get nickel-56 in the explosive nucleosynthesis in the shell, but we also might be able to make it in the outflow from the accretion disk. And we have to figure out how much nickel can contribute from this scenario. Also, we can get some other rare nuclear species popping out, which may become important. Now, gamma ray bursts in general are very rare, and so you don't expect them to contribute a whole lot to the galactic nucleosynthesis. What is happening?
We're trying to reduce the light so we can see them. Is there, are there any control lights right down there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that is good. Okay. There you go.
It's still.
No, I
didn't. Okay. Moving on. Okay. So again, gamma ray bursts are too rare to contribute all that much toward the galactic inventory of elements, but they could contribute to some rare nuclear species. And what I mean by rare nuclear species, you can see illustrated in this plot here. This is the solar system abundances of nuclei versus mass number. And we can see that we mostly have hydrogen and other and products of fusion installed in the higher group nuclei. And the rest of the nuclei are orders of magnitude more or less abundant. You can see this is a log plot. So these nuclei are, again, much, much less abundant than the bulk of the material.
What's the red line?
The red line is my arbitrary line to say everything below that line is rare. So we want to think, can we make any of these nuclei in a gamma ray burst? We additionally can divide the rare nuclear species up according to their mechanism, roughly their mechanisms of production. Here I'll illustrate it with a chart of the nuclei. So the proton number increasing here, increasing neutron number. These black squares are all stable nuclei. And we can divide up all of these heavy nuclei into three groups. We have the nuclei right along the valley of stability here. And these are produced in the S process, which is slow neutron capture. Neutron capture is followed by beta decay, and that builds up nuclei right along the valley of stability. Nuclei to the right of this line are more neutron rich. These are produced in rapid neutron capture, where neutron capture happens faster than beta decays. The nuclei to the left of that line are proton-rich, and they're called p-nuclei, and there's several mechanisms by which you can produce these. So the S process is pretty well understood, but the R and P processes are not finished deal. There's still a lot of open questions there, and so we want to know, can gamma ray bursts contribute to these elements? Okay. So our calculation proceeds by, again, I have another one of these silly cartoons to show you what's going on here. We're following material as it's processed through the disk, and then as it's launched in the outflow. Now, it's important to follow the whole trajectory of the material because the material in the disk is going to be broken down into the constituent protons and neutrons. The disk is really hot and dense, And essentially, in the inner regions, we just have protons and neutrons, along with a sea of electrons and positrons. And so it's these weak interactions between the nucleons and electrons and positrons that sets the neutron-to-proton ratio in the material. Now, the neutron-to-proton ratio in the material is the most important determining factor for the subsequent nucleosynthesis. So you have to follow it carefully, again, in the disk, and then as the material is launched. Okay. So I've mentioned this already, the neutron-to-proton ratio is the key. We need to get that number to figure out what's going to happen when the nuclei reassemble. We usually talk about electron fractions instead of neutron-to-proton ratio. Essentially, it's related to the abundance of protons and neutrons as I show here. But keep in mind, an electron fraction of a half corresponds to a neutron-to-proton ratio of 1. So if we have lower electron fractions, then the material is more neutron-rich. Higher electron fractions is the opposite. And in the disk, and in the first part of the outflow, the neutron-to-proton ratio, or the electron fraction, is determined by these weak interactions. Electron capture on protons and positron capture on neutrons. In a disk, this reaction tends to dominate, and so we get lots of neutrons produced. But in the inner regions, we get more positrons, so we start to see the influence of this reaction. But also, we can see the influence of the reverse reactions, particularly where the neutrinos become trapped. Okay, now Gail talked about this yesterday, and she showed these pictures of the neutrino decoupling surfaces for a couple of these disk models. This is the M.10. This is an M.1 disk, where I showed the neutrino decoupling surfaces for the antineutrinos and the neutrinos. In the regions outside of these decoupling surfaces, we calculate the neutrino flux from just the neutrinos emitted by positron or electron capture. But within the surfaces and outside the surfaces, we take them to be thermal fluxes with a temperature equal to the temperature at the point where they decouple. Okay, so from just looking at these pictures, we can tell something about the nucleosynthesis that we're going to get from these disks. Okay. We look at the M.10, we have large regions in which both the neutrinos and the antineutrinos are trapped. However, the antineutrinos are trapped deeper within the disk. This means that they're going to be coming out at higher temperature. So for these disks, we're going to see predominantly this reaction driven in the outflow. So we're going to make protons, we're going to make neutrons from protons primarily in these disks. And we can expect that the outflow is going to be neutron-rich. In the M.1 or M.0.1, where you have a very small antineutrino surface, or it's completely gone and the antineutrinos aren't trapped at all, it turns out that the electron flux will dominate. The electron neutrino flux will dominate. Again, because we have mostly electron capture in the disk, so we're producing more electron neutrinos in the optically thin regions. And here, the trapping region for the neutrinos is larger, so we get a larger thermal flux there too. So in these cases, we expect, in the outflow, the neutrino capture on neutrons to predominate, and we should see proton-rich outflows.
So did you say outside of the neutrino sphere, you only include positron-electron capture neutrinos?
That's right.
Is there direct Birka neutrinos?
The fluxes are much, much smaller.
Okay.
Yeah. I calculated the comparison, and then they just are inconsequential compared to that. Okay. So we start out with these very nice disk models from Pakamuki and Fryer and Mathea, Pranya, and Orion that Gail talked about yesterday. But when we get to the outflow, we're in a little more of a hazy situation. So we take a parameterization from the outflow with the hope that whatever sophisticated physics is eventually developed to describe the outflow will fall somewhere within our parameterization. So we're starting with just a simple wind solution for the velocity. The velocity is a function of radial distance from the black hole. This coastwind velocity will be a fraction of the speed of light. And the beta is a parameter that governs how rapidly the material accelerates. So if we have a beta of 0.2, this is very rapid acceleration of the material. Beta of 2.5 is much slower. The beta parameter is going to be key here when we look at the influence of neutrinos. Because if we have a very slow accelerating outflow, that means we have lots of time for the neutrinos to hit this material from behind. And we'll see a larger influence of the neutrinos for the slow beta. Now we take our flows to be completely adiabatic. We'll start with entropies from 10 to 50. The entropy in the disk is fairly low. It's a little less than 10. So we take that as a starting point. And then we also allow for some moderate heating. And we take the flow to be vertical from the disk and then immediately.
And the flow extends all radiuses from, when the neutrinos are optically thick out to where they're...
Yes. We're taking the neutrinos from the entire disk when we look at the outflows from the disk, but we also can vary the launch point of the material, and that's another thing that's unclear, where to launch the material from.
But there's no reason to expect maybe a change in the outflow properties when you go from different, when you have optically thick neutrinos to optically thin neutrinos?
Again, we're just using a parameterization from the outflow. So what actual physics will govern that material is yet to be determined. But certainly, if you launch your outflow from the optically thick region, you're going to get lots more neutrino flux hitting it because it's going to be right underneath. So it's going to change the nucleus system.
So this velocity law that you assume is sort of got again from different models, or is this something that you put in the parameters, V infinity and beta?
This is a model that we came up with by talking to some hydrodynamicists who said that this is a standard solution.
Well, it is for if you have disk winds or something, for example, people have worked out for Aegean winds, but I'm just wondering, so do you get your beta and your V infinity from some model, or do you?
No, we use them as totally free parameters.
Oh, okay.
But actually, we do constrain this V infinity a little bit because we say that the nickel seems to be coming out about the tenth of the speed of light. So that's what we use mostly.
Yeah, because even the beta is constrained by a lot of disk wind models. But fortunately, there are different models which give you different constraints.
That's right. So we didn't know what to do. So we just picked a whole big range that seemed physical. We couldn't get the too big beta because then the stuff just sits above the disk for a long time and that is unphysical.
Well, for light-driven winds, you're going to get 0.7 points. 6.7, and that's usually what people use.
Yeah, well, that's it within our range. So here's a little graph to show you a couple examples of influence of neutrinos in these outflows. This is the electron fraction of the material to the point of nuclear recombination for two trajectories from two different disk models. One is the 0.1 disk, and one is the 10 disk, both hematite. Even if they all turned out to be Orion disks. We're starting at 0.1C, as I said. These are fairly high entropy and slow beta, so we see a very large effect of the neutrinos in these two trajectories. And which way the trajectory goes depends entirely on what's going on within those neutrino surfaces. Again, when we have large regions of trapped antineutrinos, the antineutrino flux that ends up determining the electron fractions. So what we see is we start out with a very low electron fraction in the disk, and because we have so much heating, the electron fraction quickly rises as we get above the disk and approaches 0.5. But what happens next is determined again by the neutrinos. For the m.dot of 10 disk, the antineutrinos drive the electron fraction very low. But for the m.dot of 1 disk, the electron neutrinos drive the material very proton rich, and we get electron fraction is close to 50. These are kind of extreme cases. We'll see all cases in between. Okay. Now to follow the nuclear recombination, we need a nuclear network code. We're using the code of Rate Hicks, which we have modified to include the neutrino interactions. Now, when we get to some heavy element synthesis, we switch over to an R process nucleosynthesis code that was originally written by Jim Walsh at Clemson. And again, to keep in mind what we're looking for, we're looking number one for nickel 56, and then we'll also look for the rare nuclear species. Okay, so let's talk about the nickel first. So to get nickel, you need a high electron fraction. And this is a plot of the nickel production, the nickel mass fraction, for an m-dot of 0.1 disk. These parameters shown. This is, I'm showing the contour plot as a function of entropy and a beta. Remember that these are very rapidly accelerating flows here, and these are more slowly accelerating flows up here. And on top of the Napel mass fraction data, I've overlaid contours of constant electron fraction. So you can see that the nickel production, as we expect, is primarily between 0.5 and 0.55, just when you have about equal numbers of protons and neutrons, you get lots and lots of nickel. Less nickel as the electron fraction increases and nothing below 0.5. Okay, here's another plot of nickel mass fraction for m dot of 1. Now this plot looks a little bit crazier because we have much more going on here. First of all, we're starting out with a disk that's more neutron rich. So we have a possibility of very low electron fractions where we have low entropy. So if we keep low entropy and we have a low disk electron fraction, then we're going to stay low in the outflow. But if we have higher entropy or very slow accelerations, then we can get very high electron fractions. We have a whole broad range shown here. And again, it correlates very nicely with the nickel. You get the most nickel. Over half of the mass ejected is in nickel for YEs of between 0.5 and 0.55. Okay, so the next question is, what do we get along with this nickel? For proton-rich flows, what else can we make? Well, some nuclei that we can make include nuclei like zinc-64, titanium-49, and scandium-45, which are underproduced in galactic chemical evolution studies. So these are nuclei in the iron group, and we're really not sure where they come from. So what I'm plotting here is an overproduction factor for these nuclei, where I take the mass fraction that I calculate in the wind, I divide it by the solar mass fraction, and then I use a weighting, which weights the mass ejected in the wind to that of a supernova. So this is uncertain, of course. I'm thinking it to be 0.1, but this will be refined as models continue to refine this. So here I show overproduction factors in the darkest regions of greater than 1,000 for a whole broad range of parameter space for Z64, and lesser overproduction factors, but still significant, for titanium and scandium. Now, what's interesting in these plots is that most of this production seems to be driven by electron fraction here, except for the titanium and the zinc at very high beta. This is where the material is accelerating very slowly, and the neutrinos actually drive you through some waiting points for these nuclei. Okay, and these, again, this is a 0.1 disk model, so you don't. There's no trapping here, the neutrinos can still have a big effect. Okay. And along with these interesting iron peak nuclei, we can also make a whole host of light peak process nuclei. So these are similar overproduction plots where the darkest regions are overproduction factors of over 1,000 for a handful of again, light peak process nuclei. You see, we robustly produce these nuclei for a broad range of the parameter space. Again, these are the same 0.1 solar mass per second disk models.
Can you remind me just on any of these draws, roughly where's the YE 0.5 line?
It's around here.
So you're making peak process nuclei even though it's neutron rich?
Well, it's not that neutron rich. The YE is just below 0.5. I think that's enough to get you past some waiting points.
Yeah, let's see.
Okay, so where does this fit in with the whole scheme of p-process nuclei? Well, the heavier p-process nuclei, such as the ones I list here, appear to be produced in quoted association reactions and supernovae. This seems to produce the required abundances pretty well. But the situation for the light p-process nuclei is much murkier. These are a factor of 100 more abundant than the heavy ones, so it's clearly they have a different mechanism of production. And it seems that they should be produced in explosive proton capture, but the site that they're produced and the method by which they are produced is quite unclear. And it appears, according to our overproduction factors, that we very robustly produce these nuclei. Okay. But on the other hand, if you go to neutron-rich ejecta, such that we get for an m dot of 10, we actually get an R process. Now the plot I'm showing here is a plot of our process abundance distribution for the solar system and crosses as a function of mass number. We can see the evidence for the three main peaks of the solar process. This is A equals 80, A equals 130, and A equals 195. And these peaks are associated with closed neutron shells, so the nuclear structure effects. And on top of that, I've shown two of my trajectories. One is a low entropy trajectory, so the neutron fraction remains pretty low here just because the entropy is low. But we also see a nice R process for a high entropy trajectory with a slow beta. Now this slow beta means that material is getting hit by the neutrinos and the electron fraction is totally dominated by the neutrino effects. And so that keeps it low enough to get a very robust, in that case, the solid line with the S equals 51, get a very robust third peak. So if we see the whole parameter space again, we see that we robustly produce these very neutron-rich peaks for a bit of the parameter space, but we very robustly produce the second R process peak. So the A equals 130 peak is one right here. We very robustly produce this over the whole range of our parameter space. And for the rest, we do see the first R process peak, except in this little corner right here where we actually make nickel. These are totally rich in that corner. So how does this fit with the overall scheme of our process of photosynthesis? Well, we can get a clue by looking at some data from the metal poor halo stars. So here's a plot of some our process abundances for this particular halo star, along with the solar system abundances. Now this plot looks a little different from the other one I showed you because it's a function of atomic number instead of atomic mass. But we can still see the three peaks for the solar system, which is in blue. We can see that the halo star matches very nicely with the solar system data for particularly the third peak and in between the second and third peaks. Okay, so this suggests that you have some mechanism that's producing our process nuclei that's operating very early in the galactic history. Now, the possible astrophysical sites that have been proposed for the R process, such as neutron star mergers or quark collapse supernovae, this seems to suggest that quark collapse supernovae are the best choice. However, studies of quark collapse supernovae in the R process fail to reproduce the abundance pattern well unless you invoke some sort of new particle physics. So it's unclear, the situation there is unclear, and how did the gamma ray burst fit in with that? Well, it seems clear that we only get a good R process where the antineutrinos have a large track region, which is only available if you have very high accretion rate disk or some very high spin parameter. So if a collapse star is going to produce a robust R process, it's going to need to go through some phase where it's accreting really rapidly. Another possibility is that gamma ray bursts could contribute to the lighter R process nuclei. It seems clear from this plot and from additional meteoritic data that there are two sites for the R process, one that produces these really heavy things, and the other, which operates on a different time scale, that produces the first peak. And as I've shown in that contour plot, and I'll show again in this little inset, we, for a very large region of our parameter space, do produce this first peak. And here's a couple of trajectories. Again, it's a solar R process distribution where I show that we just get that first peak. Okay, so it's possible that gamma ray bursts could contribute to this R process in this way. Okay, so just to sum up, given the disk and the outflow parameters, I can tell what's going to happen with the nucleosynthesis by looking at the neutrinos. And the kinds of nucleosynthesis I get out are very interesting. We can get lots of nickel in certain situations. And we can also get some lighter intermediate mass proton rich nuclei whose origins are unclear, or maybe even in our process.
So in the cases where you're getting a lot of nickel production, what kind of densities do you want in the medium of the disk?
Densities in the medium of the disk. Well, the disk itself is 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11 grams per centimeter. And then, so that the density is just going to decrease as you are injecting the alcohol. So, you know, you drop about an order of magnitude when you get above the density, and then it drops from there.
So just to be able to be in the parameter regime where you get a lot of nickel production, does that rule out being able to produce things like jets, or you know, at least neutrino-driven jets, to be able to have these processes happening?
Well, I think that they're totally different questions. I mean, I'm thinking here about just material that's driven off in the wind from the disk itself, and it's not involved with the jet. The jet is happening in the middle. My disk profile here, the eject is coming from somewhere here, and the jet is coming through the middle.
Okay.
So I don't think they interact at all.
About the double neutron stars, what do they, if you merge them, what did people make calculations of?
Sure. So what can happen if in a colliding neutron star, you can eject neutron-rich material right out, spread out of the sides, and that can combine to form a Mach process too.
But did people really do calculations on the quantitative?
Mm-hmm.
And
what about the quantitative? Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
This is Fiegel Tiedemann with Stefan Roswald and Adam LaPelle.
Oh, okay.
I have a current concern, and I haven't looked at the results carefully enough, but by comments Stefan has made to me, I think the way they did this, they had the particles moving off, they'd done the hydrodynamics. So then Fiegel put a network on top and determined the temperature of the material by the nuclear burning. And the problem with doing it in that way is that he didn't allow for adiabatic. If you heat something up, it'll immediately start to cool. And instead, he allowed it to overheat. So his yields may be wrong, this is just from a comment to Stefan saying, oh, well, you can get the yields yourself, just make sure you put the heat in. And I said, but you don't want to put the heat in. And so he and I were arguing about whether you should put the heat in. And we've at least tried it both ways, and just explosive nuclear synthesis, and you would get quite a different answer for one radiator. So it may have been done in detail, but it may be worth redoing it.
And what fraction of the mass is ejected from the double neutron star when they merge? 100
solar masses. 100 solar masses.
100 solar masses.
You need almost a tenth if you want to make all of the
okay.
But the issue there anyway is that they found that double neutron star mergers and gamma ray bursts will have the same problem. They're not often enough to get, well, if you believe the observers that everything looks nice and smooth, there's a paper by Friedel with Yong Chin saying, oh, double neutron star mergers can't do it just based on the fact that their event rate is too rare.
Okay.
That's based on the meteoritic data.
Yeah. So it certainly isn't a solved problem, that's for sure.
Okay. So I was wondering, you said, I guess these results are very sensitive to the disk and outflow parameters. So have you tried like different disk models and seen how much the yields differ at all?
Well, we have two sets of disk models right now that we've used so far. Well, they're pretty different just because one set of disk models doesn't include neutrino trapping, and the other does. So we definitely get different results out of it.
And by not including neutrino trapping, is that something that should be included?
Yeah.
Well, not for the low accretion rate disk, you know, but 0.1 or less, it's probably not important unless you have a high spin parameter. Because if you do get trapping, if you look at 0.1 disks that have spin parameter of 0.95, it's traveling around.
But like, yeah. Have you tried different extremes or just to see like how much the results would actually differ?
Well, again, we've done the extremes that you see in our contour plots. So that's a pretty broad range of parameters. We certainly could broaden them more.
No, I don't know what the range is. I'm wondering if.
Yeah.
I think that probably the difference between models is going to be smaller than the unknown parameter space that we're
okay, that's
So after the winds leave the disk, I guess there's still the remnant of the star there, right? So what happens
That's
to the
true.
What happens to the composition and stuff when it?
Well, we haven't considered what happens when the outflow actually collides with the rest of the star.
Okay.
But the rest of the star is also expanding, so.
What are the main things that you see?
Well, the most of the things that I showed there are the nickel speed one. And we did that because that seems to be the nickel.
So the issue is that those outflows, that's a good estimate for the outflow velocity. And so not only may those outflows have nickel, but whatever they hit of the star, at least all through the oxygen there is probably going to get burned to nickel as
right,
well.
Right, right.
So, but you kind of, so that's, I mean, so you're going to, that's the other way you're making nickel. That's the explosive nucleus.
But it just means there's another processing step above what maybe she did from the disk, nucleosynthesis, to understand what the nucleosynthesis you'd actually see would be, or would actually go out into the universe.
It depends on how much you
need
to get off the nucleosynthesis.
Good shot.
Yeah, so your heavy, what happens if your heavy stuff, I would think that the heavy stuff they make is going to stay heavy stuff. It's not going to change. So I think the heavy, but I don't know what I'm going to say.
How much of the nickel that you're getting is because you started with something that was low YE, but the neutrinos have reset the YE to higher, but it's still at temperatures and such that it's kind of an MSE. So how much of it is just the MSE abundance of nickel?
Well, or that's got the YE case, it's mostly MSE.
Okay,
the neutrinos aren't really influenced.
The neutrinos reset it so that it could be in the range where NSE can turn it into.
That's right, but it's not necessarily the neutrinos aren't changing the head of the element.
Right.
Well,
except in that zinc.
Except in the zinc, okay. But not the nickel. I don't think the nickel except for the nickel. Yeah.
Right,
and
then
there
you're saying
this is, of course, a very sensitive thing you tell us, right? Because you said the other types of nucleosynthesis never produce these large amounts of zinc which you need from the observations. So this seems to be a diagnostic that you really are dealing with these disks.
Well, would be the hope once the models get more sophisticated, is that we could use the nucleosynthesis to then trace back and say which models do they have.
But then I guess you go back to the question of like whether all that stuff that you produce at the disk is actually coming out from the star. I mean, you are using the velocity of 30,000. Shock velocities that break out are about the same 30,000. I don't know whether there would be any interaction at all between this kind of a wind and the stuff coming out.
I think the outflow velocity is somewhat uncertain.
Pardon?
Yes. The outflow velocity of the disk is somewhat uncertain.
Sure, no, but the one that she's used is 30,000 kilometers per second.
Yeah, that, I guess, suppresses the chances for having these crystals refer to the explosive nucleosynthesis when you have this simple kinetic collision between outflow and pressure from the remnant star.
Suppose
so, in fact, that might be a discriminant between having the nucleosynthesis from a GRB, when you say a long GRB, and say some subcolisms, because in the second case, well, there is no pretty energy star, or it was there many years ago. But so the contribution of this explosive mechanism may be more pronounced, and may actually be relevant in the long GRBs. And likewise, perhaps not in the short GRBs, when there is some bipolar colors. So I don't know how that plays out. If you push here, the velocity is much higher, to say gamma is 2 on the disk ring. When does the explosive start to dominate this process?
Did you change V infinity at all?
Yeah, we didn't loop right around the local.
But not like 25-30% or so?
Yeah, well, I think my whole range, this is the range.
Oh, okay. That should be more than covering everything.
No, I don't think so.
Really?
No. Because it could be, if you have additional input from the negative force of driving winds, it's all depends on the barium loading. I mean, how much, you know, it's 10 to 30 grams per second or 31 grams per second, whether or not it is. That really then sense, you know, velocity. So yeah, it could be much higher.